You're back home. You're not in your caravan anymore there, Jeanette.
You're the spot. There you go, Jeanette.
Can you hear me now?
Now, yep. Now we can.
Thank goodness for that. I'm not feeling too good this morning, so I might leave early.
Sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to join in the class to see how I go.
Okay, yeah, good on you.
Yeah.
I had a terrible experience last night, Eddie.
What happened?
Oh, I don't know if I've got time. It's quite a long story, and I don't want to interrupt the class. But I feel terrible now. It was all to do with a cockroach.
It's bad.
I went into the bathroom. No, it was real. I went into the bathroom. Tell me to stop if I'm going on too long, Miffy.
Oh.
I went into the bathroom to brush my teeth, and this cockroach ran out from under my feet. I get the fright of my life, and I scream. So Willie shouts, "What's wrong?" And I says, cockroach. So he comes through, and he says, "All right, I'll go and get a spray." And right away, I thought, oh, my God, we're going to kill this cockroach. So while he's downstairs looking for a spray, I'm down on the floor in the bathroom, looking underneath the bed, the bathroom cabinet for this cockroach. And I can see it hiding behind one of the legs. So yeah. I'm saying to it, I'm having a little conversation with it. I think you should leave this bathroom because Willie has gone down to get a spray. And I'm telling it, if it says here, it's definitely going to die because this spray is toxic.
Yeah.
But it didn't move. So by the time Willie came back up, I'm still on the floor talking about the cockroach. And he sprays this cockroach. And the thing came running out, ran over me again, went into his bedroom, and I thought, well, I did my best.
Yeah.
Right, a minute later, I went back into the bathroom to brush my teeth, and I started to feel really funny, and I started to choke, and then I started to cough, and I thought, what is happening? And I couldn't stop the coughing, and then I couldn't breathe. And it was getting worse and worse, and I'm like this.
That's
how bad it was. And we're running into the living room, and Willie's just sitting there, and I'm going, couldn't talk, couldn't breathe. And that went on for, it felt like 10 minutes, but I think it was maybe just about 5 minutes before I actually could breathe again. So it must have been something in that spray.
Sure.
Now, the thing that is bothering me is I've been spraying my house for 40 years and never once thought what happens to those cockroaches when they breathe that in.
Yeah.
While I was going, last night, do you know what I was thinking about?
Yeah.
I was thinking about all the people in all these gas chambers during the war. I'm thinking, this is how it must have been like.
Because
I felt as if I was going to die.
For sure.
And then when I get back to normal, I started to think about the cockroaches. I've been spraying them for 40 years, never thinking, well, the spray will kill them, but never thinking how the process goes, how they die.
Yeah.
And I was saying to myself, my God, I wouldn't wish that on my enemy for what I went through for that 5 minutes. I thought I was going to die. And if they get through something like that, there's no way I want to inflict that on anything, on any creature. Couldn't sleep last night. Couldn't sleep at all last night, just for thinking the whole thing over.
Sure.
So that's why I'm not feeling too good this morning. But what do you do at Langley Tampa for your pest control?
Well, we have as many preventative measures as we can. So we've got our termite barrier. That's not the one that they take the bait back to the nest and die, but it's just that if they cross over it, then they die. So it's the least, it's a harm minimization thing. So it's got to be like this balance between a prevention. And then we have surface spray onto like surfaces where there's, you know, we don't actually have the cockroaches there so that they don't get a chance to move in. And that's as much as we can do. And then there are also the geckos. So there's the natural ecosystem. We catch them when because in Queensland there's flying cockroaches, right? So they fly in. So we catch them and take them back out again.
Yeah, I know. I got one in the other day, but It's made me feel really depressed that I've been killing these cockroaches and they've had to go through so much agony if that's what happens to them.
That's right.
When they breathe it in.
At least the feeling bad for them, that's part one of your purification process, of the regret, of real natural regret for what's happened. And, you know, like in the Guru Puja where we retake the vows, and it's like part of that retaking the vows is may I give breath to those unable to breathe. I mean, it's really powerful.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what I'm going to do in the future now, because Willie is that we've had the house sprayed for over 40 years and I can't see him giving it up. I've got to find some kind of solution to it. It's driving me insane. It really is, because of the pain that I went through last night. And I thought, if these creatures go through that, I can't do that to them.
One thing they do up north, Jeanette, if I really quickly, is that you put your plugs in your plug holes and just cover over your sink, your shower drain, any drains you have, because that's where they come up, is up through the drains. And if you put a cover over them, not that good in the laundry if you let your tub run over and you've got the drain covered over and then your house floods, but it is a barrier for them. But people up north do it a lot because they have all cockroaches you could bloody ride to town on. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I'll keep that in mind. I got to do a bit of research today.
Okay, well, it's been a class then. We can start off by thinking about what our intention is by doing a class like this on the perfections. Think about what we're trying to accomplish. You know, so, of course, the great aim is to become a fully enlightened being, a Buddha, but that is highly dependent upon our wisdom and our compassion. So we need to develop both of those. I was about to say the wings of compassion and wisdom.
The cockroach wings.
Cockroach wings, yeah. So we need to develop these anyway. So let's think that by coming along to these classes, that's our intention, to develop wisdom and compassion so that we can deal skillfully with the different types of problems that we encounter in this sort of samsaric existence we're in. So, you know, we're engaged in this practice of the six perfections, and we're up to a section at the moment where we're sort of combining concentration and wisdom. Here, concentration is called stabilization. So it's the stabilizing practices and the wisdom practices, and it's like a sort of an overview of what is to come. So I'll open up the other slides now. We can take refuge together, generate the mind of enlightenment, and then we'll have a look at the class. So I think that all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present. They've acknowledged our aspiration, and we're going to take refuge in front of them. So join me. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then, if you can recollect how the four immeasurables were recited, just think of them now. We want our love to be immeasurable, our compassion to be immeasurable, our joy and our equanimity to embrace all living beings and to deliver them into those four immeasurable states. Then see yourself making prostrations in front of the refuge field, making offerings and then confessing. then rejoice that you have the Dharma to rely upon and you are engaged in doing the best you can to practice it. Also rejoice in others' kindness and virtue. We will make requests and dedicate everything that we're doing to the goal that we're seeking, full enlightenment. And then we'll offer this mandala. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnariyata Yami. So Lama Tsongkhapa and his merit field accept the offering and smile at us with delight. And you think that an emanation of Lama Tsongkhapa enters you, blesses your mind, and allows you to be open and accepting of the teachings to come. Okay. So, let's have a look now at what we're doing. So, like I said, we're coming up to the end of Volume 2. I think next week we finish Volume 2. So we've got 20 questions, and they're based around primarily wisdom and a little bit about stabilization and so forth. And I've been relying upon these particular texts and Kensa Rinpoche's commentary. So I think Miffy put up some of the teachings last night, so I hope you get access to those. So our first question was, what are the three different types of wisdom and their causes? So can anybody just off the top of their head know what they are?
Study, reflection, and meditation.
That's right. These are the three types of wisdom. The wisdom of study, the wisdom of reflection or contemplation, and the wisdom that arises through meditation. And these three types of wisdom have causes. So let's put up what the causes are for the wisdom of study. So these are your ability to listen and to read. So from reading and listening to the teachings, you develop the wisdom that has arisen from that. In terms of the contemplative wisdom or reflective wisdom, this arises through you thinking about it and debating. So to think about it doesn't mean that we just think as we normally think. We have to do that as well. But the thinking here really has to do with the reasoning. So that's where you get the syllogisms, and having the three parts have to be sort of correct. Once you're satisfied with that, you memorize it, and then you can debate with others or with yourself. And finally, we have the wisdom arising from our meditation. So this meditative wisdom has these other two parts supporting it. It helps you to become familiar. And with your familiarity, what you do is you absorb your understanding of what you have gathered through the study of wisdom and reflective wisdom. So you let it sort of sink into you. And in that way, this is called meditation. So if you know if you've been trying to do, for instance, suppose you've been studying on wisdom, the wisdom realizing emptiness. So you would come up with some of these, the reasons, and you might even try and apply the wisdom to try and get a meditative experience. And what you're doing there is absorbing the mind on the absence of what seemed to truly exist. And so you just rest the mind of that, the absence. And that way we get familiar with at least the conceptual understanding of the emptiness of some form of some type of phenomena, whether it be yourself or something else. The next question is about this process, really, and in particular our study. And the question is, why is study presented as being really important? So some of you will know that whenever we've taken teachings by Khyentse Rinpoche, he's always going, study, study, study. And when they use that term study, they mean these three things together. They don't mean just listening and reading. They mean all three together. Because the word study sort of has these three aspects contained within it. So Geshe Sopa says, you know, wisdom is the direct antidote to ignorance. There's no other way to eliminate wrong ideas, whether you're in the desire realm, the form realm, or the formless realm. And it's the direct realization of emptiness, knowing that things do not exist as they appear. This knowledge, this wisdom, is the supreme wisdom. So then the question is, where does this wisdom come from? And we can look at this here and just go backwards. It comes from study. The supreme wisdom of emptiness comes from the study of what it means for something to lack inherent existence, to be empty. So without studying or without learning, we can't open ourselves to wisdom. And without study, we don't even know what wisdom is, much less know how to attain it. So I've taken this quote from, which was in the Lamrim Chenmo, to sort of hope to demonstrate the importance of study. As you can see, it says, other than wisdom, there is nothing that causes elimination of these obscurations. Therefore, wisdom is supreme. Its foundation is learning. So, study is supreme. And so Khyentse Rinpoche often says this too, and this is what Geshe Sharawa also said, and was also in Geshe Sopa's book. Geshe Sharawa was a famous yogi, and he said that until we become enlightened, there is always something we have to develop. There's always something we need to learn. I remember Geshe often saying that our study should go all the way up to our death, basically, and we're just going to have to keep on studying until we're enlightened.
Yeah, because Eddie, I remember Geshe-la saying, you know, the path of no more learning, Buddhahood actually means that's the path of no more study. And up until then, it's study. But, yeah. I mean, it's a really important point because we just kind of expect to be able to get things intuitively. And it's hard to follow the instructions to even think, oh, that's right, let's read the instructions first. It's not a normal thing for us to do, to actually dive into study. We just kind of think we'll figure it out as we go along.
And who has that sort of problem where you think, well, I've read it or I have studied it? I'm sure we all do, right? And then a week later or something, somebody asks us about it, we don't know. It's like we didn't get up to the second little part, we've read and listened, but we actually haven't moved beyond that.
Yep. So then we just forget instead of have it to draw on.
Yeah. So there's so even though we study now and we will continue to study using those three methods of listening and reading and contemplating through debate and reasoning, nevertheless, we all know that we have difficulties with study. We have what they call we meet up with obstacles, what they call obscurations. And these obscurations make study difficult for us. They help us forget what we've studied, and they prevent our retaining the knowledge, and they prevent us using the knowledge. So these obstacles, in this case called obscurations, are of two types. So this, it says my internet connection is unstable with you.
Yeah, I know.
So I've given this picture up here. Can anybody see these two pictures? This is a big hint to show you what the two obstacles are. Can anybody just tell me off without looking it up? Sue or?
Wanting to attain liberation for oneself.
Obstacles to liberation, yep.
And obstacles to Buddhahood.
That's right. And what are those ones called? The obstacles to Buddhahood?
Cognitive obscurations.
Yeah, that's right. So we have obstacles to liberation called afflictive obscurations, and then we have obstacles to Buddhahood called cognitive obscurations. Now, what these are differs according to the different tenet systems. So some groups of people will say, these are what the obstacles to liberation are. And these are what those to cognitive are. And these obstacles, especially the obstacles to liberation, can be what they call gross or subtle, and even very subtle. So we're doing a course... I've been presenting a course for one of the American centers. And in there, I've been looking at the different types of these obstacles. So we see we have, for instance, we have anger. Anger can be gross, subtle, very subtle. So for instance, if you get scared, by like a cockroach, for instance, something scares you like that, and this is you scream, somebody comes and goes, what happened? This happened, they go, I'm going to kill it. So this willingness to harm straight up, like that's called a gross obscuration. You can say that's gross anger, willingness to harm something. But then suppose you go, okay, that's gross, then you find that you can't sleep. Or if you do sleep, you have these terrible dreams. There is subtle anger. Because even in dreams, you can have things where you want to kill things, or things threaten you and you attack them. So there we have the subtle anger. And that anger can manifest in dreams. It could also manifest in the bardo state. And then it diminishes as you go through the dying process. So you know that when you have the different appearances, the red, the white, the red, and the black. So while that is going on, at the very same time, these subtle afflictions are losing their power until you come down to the white and then the clear. But then as you come to take rebirth again and go through the bala, they arise again until you come back out in this world, and then you've got anger again. So these are in terms of the obstacles to liberation, knowing that they are, we could talk about it from a gross level, a subtle level, and a very subtle level. And as I said, there are different systems of tenet systems, as we're going to have some questions shortly about them, about what are these obstacles to liberation and what are the obstacles to Buddhahood. So let's have a look first at what the middle way autonomists have to say. Now, the middle way autonomists, their presentation is very similar to the mind only and any system like below it. So in terms of the afflictive obscurations, these people, the middle way autonomists, say that the most subtle of them is the grasping at the self of persons. And all the other schools agree. They go, yep, we all agree. This is the most subtle obscuration of all. Grasping at the self of persons. But then when they say, well, what exactly is that? Then the middle way autonomists will say it is grasping at the person to be self-sufficient or substantially existent. This is the most subtle afflictive obscuration. This is subtle grasping at persons. Is that clear for everybody? Now, they also have a presentation of grasping at the self of phenomena. That means a thing that's other than the person. Now, these things that can be other than the person could be the aggregates of the person. So they could be the feelings, the body, all these sort of things.
Yeah, so that's the tricky bit, thoughts. Eddie, that bit of that you can have a person and it can be both person and phenomena.
And so persons are a subset of phenomena, aren't they? So here we've got like a picture of like a waterfall to demonstrate like how these cognitive obscurations sort of work. But it's like a phenomena other than the person. Right? So feelings are not the person. The body is not the person. Water is not the person. Trees are not the person. Right? They are called phenomena. And these two can be grasped at to exist in a particular way, which is false. So the middle way autonomists say that when you grasp at the self of phenomena, you are grasping at that phenomena to truly exist. And that is a cognitive obscuration. So you can see here that there's differences, isn't there? We've got the word truly exist, and then we've got self-sufficient or substantially exist. So this presentation is the same for like the mind only and the middle way autonomists. So what would be the emptiness of the person according to the middle way autonomists then? Anybody?
Lack of a substantially self-sufficient, substantially existent person.
That's right. That the person would be empty of a self-sufficiency or a substantial existence, isn't it? And in terms of the phenomena, what would be it? What would be the answer there? The phenomena are empty of any true existence. So here's the obscuration that the persons are self-sufficient or substantially existent, and you remove it, the person is empty of self-sufficiency or substantial existence. And they're saying that is the subtle emptiness of the person. So mind only and middle way autonomists, this is their presentation.
Excuse me, Eddie.
Yep, sir.
Truly existent for the middle way autonomy school, does that mean something different to the middle way consequence school?
Yes, it does. In fact, these terms, true existence and self-sufficient or substantially existent, from the middle way consequence position, they're all the same. They're just similes.
So,
yes.
Sorry, Jeanette, here you go.
Jeanette, you go first.
No, it's okay. So, Eddie, oh, sorry, Bruce.
No, you're right, Jeanette.
So, self-sufficient, substantially existent, and to truly exist all mean the same thing.
From the middle way consequence point of view, yes.
So, could you put what's under phenomenon to truly exist, could you put that under the person? It's the same thing.
From the point of view of the middle way consequence, yes.
Yeah, all yes. Right. So yep. Because truly exists means the same as self-sufficient or substantially existent from the autonomous way.
From the autonomous way, no.
No.
No, that's not from the autonomous way, no.
Oh, I don't get it.
So how does the autonomous distinguish between substantially existence and truly existent?
Well, that's what I haven't been able to find because from the Buddhist, from the middle way consequence position, they're saying to truly exist means to exist in the way that the phenomena appear to you. But that's what true existence means. It exists in the way it appears to me. It's true.
So that's like conventional appearance or conventional existence.
Well, so that would be conventional existence from the point of the middle way autonomists, but not from the point of view of the middle way consequentialists, because phenomena don't exist in the way they appear.
Yeah.
So in a way, Eddie, what we've got is, so with this one, the middle way autonomist, there is a difference between these two things. But yes, then once we get to the more subtle view of the consequentialists, there is no difference in there.
That's right.
But it is handy to know what the difference is.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But, yeah, I've never come across anything yet. It might be if anybody's doing tenets with Geshe-la to ask what does this term to truly exist mean from the middle way autonomous point of view?
It sounds like it means existence as it appears.
Yeah, like because for them, that's right. So this is a conventional existence. So they do say, if it's a conventionally existent phenomena, it truly exists, and therefore it inherently exists.
Yeah, but that sounds very much like self-sufficient or substantially existent. That's why I don't really understand the difference between person and phenomena from their point of view, from the autonomous point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
So is it a way of looking at the layers that you can go, oh, yeah, okay, so the person, the whole collection of all of these things, yeah, fair enough, doesn't exist truly or inherently, but what makes it up does. Is that what we're saying?
So, Missy, are you asking if when you say makes it up, is that the component parts?
Yeah. So that, you know, the person made up of all the parts doesn't truly exist or inherently exist, but the parts, yeah, they do. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. They exist conventionally, don't they?
Yeah, no, from this point of view of the Middle Way Autonomous, we're saying that the parts do exist.
Of course they do. Every system is saying they do exist.
Mm.
Right? But as you know, when you go through, we go, are the parts of the person? Every school will go, no, of course they're not.
So Eddie is one of...
Yeah, so there's a difference here. So, is that you, Caroline?
Yeah.
What's the question?
So just looking at the slides, and so there's obviously something important too about that phenomenon is a cognitive obscuration, which is to Buddhahood, but the person, it's an afflictive obscuration, which is to liberation. I don't quite get that difference, because looking at the next slide, which I've also got up, it's both of them under the consequence way are afflictive obscurations.
I
don't understand that difference, I don't think, in the autonomous.
What's the difference that you don't understand?
So why is phenomenon a cognitive obscuration, and phenomenon result is all said to be your, in the first instance, the aggregates?
Yeah, that's right.
So the aggregates, seeing them truly exist, is a cognitive one.
That's right.
But for person,
yeah,
is an afflictive obscuration in the way.
That's right, yeah.
I just have to think that through.
Yeah, but they can't be the same from this perspective.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But because the person isn't feelings, they're not any of the five aggregates, are they? All the schools say, what's the person? The person is merely imputed to the five aggregates.
Yeah.
So they're two different phenomena.
Yeah.
So actually this, all these different schools, the way of looking at it, it's for us, it's a process, isn't it, of just going through of levels of subtlety and kind of getting clear what each level of getting more distinct or more subtle or more clear is. So instead of settling on one or the other, it's a process.
Yeah, it's a process, but, you know, like if you go up through, you've got to settle on them and then you've got to drop them.
Yep.
Because when you drop them, because the reasoning becomes more subtle and you can see, oh, no, it can't be then. There's a fault here. Like I can agree with this part, like you could agree here, right? The person is, to see the person as this, is an afflictive obscuration. However, it's not that from the middle way consequence, well, as we'll see, this is a gross affliction. It's not the subtle affliction. And this here is also a gross affliction. A gross obscuration.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie, I have got some notes from Grounds and Paths that talk about how the middle way consequence sees true existence. Do you want to hear them?
Yep.
So the Middle Way Autonomy School says that true existence is that it exists the way that it appears, but their take on that is that that means that the object appears to be a distinct entity from its parts, but they are in fact a single entity with their parts.
Right. Okay. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And they believe that things are imputed, but that there has to be something coming from the side of the base of designation for that imputation to take place.
Yeah.
But the others, consequences don't agree with that.
That's right. Yep, that'll do it. So just go, could you just say it again, just one more time for us, Linda?
Yeah. So the object appears to be a distinct entity from its parts, but they are a single entity with their parts. So, for example, right. A building appears to be a distinct entity, but it's not.
Yep, that's right. Okay. So they can use the same terms, but the meaning is different, doesn't it? Meanings differ even though the terms are the same.
Like that's why it's so confusing.
Yeah, that's right.
Which also might make more sense if we get the next slide so we can actually see what the difference is.
Well, okay, so the difference, so here now we've got the subtle self-grasping put forward by the middleweight consequence school. So you can see here it's the persons have an inherent existence. This is the subtle grasping, and it's an afflictive obscuration. Right, so there's a difference here between this one isn't there and this one here. Here, these guys are saying it's self-sufficient and substantially existent. In fact, every school beneath them will agree with that. Because conventionally, things exist inherently. But here, the middleweight consequence saying, no, there isn't anything that exists inherently. So this is more subtle. This is the subtle grasping itself for persons to exist inherently. And the other is a gross grasping at the self to exist inherently. And this idea of inherent existence goes right across from persons and phenomena. And they're both afflictive obscurations. From the middleweight consequence position, there are no consciousnesses that are cognitive, that are obscured cognitively.
Eddie, can I just ask you the meaning of the word cognitive? Because I'm not sure. Is it did you see something? Or is it...
Cognitive just basically means knowing. An obscuration to knowing. Now, what's driving these two differences? So, from the middleway autonomy point of view, so if we just go back to middleway autonomy, yeah? So the subtle selflessness of persons and the subtle selflessness of phenomena are being differentiated according to their objective negation and not according to their base of emptiness. That's why you're getting this difference here.
Can you just repeat that?
Yeah. Yeah. The subtle selflessness of person and subtle selflessness of phenomena are differentiated according to their objective negation and not according to their base of emptiness. Because the refutation of the object of negation, you know, true existence, for instance, upon the base, the person, is the subtle selflessness of phenomena. And the refutation of self-supporting substantial existence upon the base of the person is the subtle selflessness of persons. The middleway consequence, well, they're different, right? Like the base here is the person and the phenomena. They're the bases. Now, these guys are going, no, the base that we're concerned with is the object to be negated. That's why we're getting this major difference.
So it's like one has a much tighter, more distinct focus than the other. you know, because one's really honing in on the object of negation, where the other is much more kind of blanket thing.
Yeah, the other's on the base. Right? So the middle way is on the things that are, we're determining where they have inherent existence or not, these bases called persons and phenomena. Whereas these other ones are looking at, this is the thing they're focused on, true existence, self-sufficient existence. That's their object they're focusing on. That's their base. That's the thing that's to be negated. So we get this, we get another similar type thing like this. Where else is it? In the Sakya presentation and the Galupa presentation of the two truths. So I thought when I, you know, as you study along, you would sort of think, okay, they've got it sorted. Right? Where do they get it sorted? At the level of the two truths. So what are the two truths, anybody? What are the two truths, anyone? Sue?
Conventional truth and ultimate truth.
Conventional truth and ultimate truth. That's right. What's the basis that they're aimed at? What's the basis?
Persons or phenomena?
All phenomena, isn't it? All phenomena have the an ultimate way of being and a conventional way of being. So you would think that's how it is with everybody, but it's not. So when we say phenomena, you think, well, phenomena covers everything, doesn't it? A subset of phenomena are persons, because persons are phenomena. They're functioning things. So we've got this big category called the phenomena, and with it, whatever the type of phenomena is, you can relate two truths to them. That phenomena has a conventional way of existing and an ultimate way of existence. And you would sort of think, I would think, well, everybody's got to agree with that. But they don't. Because for the Shakya presentation, what they mean by phenomena is the mind. That's the phenomena. Nothing else, the mind. Not everything, just the mind. And so now you get a completely different, you get a different presentation. So it's like, you know, it's like this thing of going, the objects, meaning all, like all phenomena, but the Shakya going, the subjects.
Ed, can I just ask you, you know, with all these different views and different schools of thought, the end result is still the same, though, isn't it, by attaining enlightenment? Or
the goal is always the same.
One school better than the other? I know they've all got the same goal, but is there a better way of following, or is it all what it is? And why are there so many different ways of doing it?
Well, that's what I was saying, you know, because if you take all phenomena, then it's like, well, phenomena, within the category of phenomena, we have subjects and objects. So where are you going to put your emphasis? That's dependent, isn't it? So if you put your emphasis on the subjects, you might get a different presentation than you would if it was objects. Just like we got this different presentation here, if you are focused on the objects to be negated rather than the bases. Different presentation.
So then, Eddie, is that different presentation then just a matter of taste of what it is that really speaks to us the most, or what approach
that's right.
helps us develop the quickest?
What suits the the person, like us. But I think this is a really interesting thing that happens over time, is that if the mind becomes less afflicted, more open, then it doesn't have these problems. It can shift from one to the other. It can look at it from the subjective side and the objective side, like we see with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, right. And it seems, Eddie, that in practice, you know, like there's these really fine, subtle distinctions intellectually when we're thinking about it. But when, you know, the great practitioners like His Holiness or Lama Yeshe or Lama Zopa talk about it, they take it from this angle and that angle, and they can kind of weave in and out of all of these different perspectives and weave them together.
Yeah. So, you know, so also you would have heard that, especially from the Gurupa presentation, right? So emptiness is a non-affirming negation. Right? So that means that whatever, philosophically, they're not pushing anything positive at all. It's just that there's an absence of something and nothing else is put in its place. Yet you'll come across this where actually emptiness is put forward as an affirming negative. Now, philosophically, the Gurupas won't have a bar of that, no way. But what about experientially? So there's a big difference between experience and philosophy. It's like Lama Tsongkhapa himself said, you know, like, had it all out here, but the actual experience of it was nothing. like what I'd thought. And you go, that's right, it shouldn't be anything like what you thought. It can't be like what you thought. and actually, it can't be what you thought. So the thinking and so forth and the reasoning and everything should bring us to a non-affirming negation. But the experience of it is like you have to know the empty. Anyway, we should know that there are different presentations here. And I sort of liked it how Geshe just brought this into our topics, you know, where we just get a little bit of it. Because I know that when you do tenets all at once, it's like that can really be overwhelming. You could just do what friends do. Like, you just go, oh, my God, like, what are they talking about? Leave me alone. Give me some space, please. I know that's what happens to me.
So, Eddie,
yeah.
From the Middle Way Consequence School, the persons are a subset of phenomena.
Yeah.
Are they continued to be discussed like that because it's refuting other schools of thought, other tenet systems? Otherwise, why would you distinguish if the principles are the same?
Yeah. The reason for distinguishing here from the middle way consequence point of view is that persons are easier. It's easier to discover that persons lack inherent existence than it is to do the phenomena. So that's why they're distinguished. And I think when you start, do it with persons.
And also like His Holiness said about, you know, it's the person that experiences the problems and the suffering. So it makes sense to start right there with the person rather than with a big philosophical worldview that's not, you know, that's unmoored from our own experience.
So just I'll add another little bit here, Linda, about this, the middle way autonomists. So for them, the two self-graspings are differentiated according to the manner of the grasping, and not according to the referent object. So the referent object, of course, is phenomena or person. It's like how they're grasped, That's where they're, that's what their thing is. But we're here, it's the phenomena. Yeah, the middle way consciousness, they look, they're grasped the same as if they're inherently existent. So I came across this explanation, which I really liked, because it really cleared things up for me. I thought, oh my God, that's why, you know, we've got this difference, why the phenomena seem to be truly existent while the persons are seen to be self-sufficient or substantially existent. They're really focusing on the object of negation, while the middle way consequences are looking at what of the bases to be negated. It's like the other one I was telling you about before, when the Shakya are looking at the mind itself, the subject, where the groupers are looking at, no, we're looking at the objects. All objects lack inherent existence. So I got this information from a book called Tenets by Geshe Sopa. So some of you might have known, so when Geshe Sopa came here, he gave on the Heart Sutra, there's a section in there about the tenet systems. And he just went through it and just took out the essential pieces.
So this is Geshe Tenzin Zopa.
Yeah, the Geshe Tenzin Zopa that comes here and gives teachings on Sundays. So he's got a little book out called Tenets, and he just sort of take out the essential pieces and put them in there. And this was one of them. I just went, man, I'd never come across that anywhere. But for me, that clarified a lot, you know. Well, we'll just do two more slides and we'll have a little break, eh? So this is the most difficult part of our conversation today. And in a fortnight's time, the most difficult one will be about going through the form and formless realms and that sort of thing, which...
Geshe Saltram.
Geshe Saltram talked about yesterday, actually. Let's just have a look at a couple of more slides and then we'll be halfway. So wisdom and virtue. The question is, as virtue is said to lead to happiness, how can wisdom be the root of happiness? And basically the source of happiness has its root in wisdom. And so, of course, we talk about how loving kindness, compassion, and the mind of enlightenment, how all of these lead to happiness. But each of these need to be combined with wisdom. Otherwise, all the only happiness we're going to get, isn't it, is the happiness of samsara. So the roots of virtue are nourished by wisdom. Therefore, wisdom is the root of happiness.
So, Eddie, I find this quite profound, because this is really different from the rest of all the other worldviews where, compassion is the support of any study or whatever, but here it's like wisdom is the support of all of our practice, all of our compassion, equanimity, everything like that. It's actually supported and comes from wisdom.
Yeah, but the Greeks also presented it like this. For them, the bottom line was wisdom. And everything was to be supported by that wisdom. It was the ancient Greeks. Anyway, let's have a little break now. Let's take 10 minutes and go off to the loo, get yourself a cup of tea or something, and we'll come back and we'll whiz through the others.
Let your head settle. Gently, nicely. Don't try grasp all. Just let it. Woo, saw me.
Yeah, the rest is easy. Yep, sure is. So we'll be starting up again shortly, but I'll just mention a couple of things about these systems called tenets. Right. So with tenets, you're seeking a tenet is a way of understanding something. But within, you can say, the whole, all the teachings of Buddhism, there is no agreement whatsoever on what lies beyond our senses. So if we're like I said, we're looking here and we look around at the world, there's no agreement whatsoever on what that is, what it's made up of. Now, I mean, you might be going, "Well, what?" But if you think about it, there's no agreement within Western science either. We can't actually get at anything objectively out there because it's got to go through our senses and our brain. So we can't get at it purely.
Or even if it doesn't go through our senses, it's got to go through various technologies.
Yeah, in science it's like, so we measure things. They use different measuring devices for the physical world.
So when you talk about tenets, is that the same as the philosophical schools?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They're all philosophical schools, Francesca. Yeah. Like I said, so in the mind-only school saying, look, there isn't anything out there objectively existing as it appears to us anyway. There's nothing like that. Great. They agree. There's nothing objectively separate from us out called the world around us. And science agrees too. Modern science agrees with that.
But again, it's what tenet in modern science, because modern science, quantum science will say there is no objective world. Yeah. But, if you're looking on a level of chemistry, you'd say, yes, there is. And so we're quite happy to accept both of those tenet systems in our Western science.
Sure. That's right. It's the same sort of thing with the Buddha Dharma. But the sort of more deeply you go into it, is very you're going to end up with having to be able to say very little about it at the end and going, whatever I'm saying, you've got to understand it's not like that. it exists, but our language is a symbolic system, is a symbol system.
So when we faith or a belief in something, then we just actually work with the one that fits in well with our minds and that we understand the best, or is there one that's better than the other?
That is a $64 million question.
Well, one of the things is, so we've got to understand what belief actually is from the point of view of the Buddhist presentation. So belief is not a correct consciousness. That's the first thing to think about. We just believe something. So we need to go deeper into the belief to see whether it is true. Then we're going to go, okay, what do we mean by true? Then we're going to get things like conventionally true, which is one of the things is like it's an agreement. If it's conventionally true, then it depends upon cause and conditions and parts. Do all these sort of make sense to us? But whatever it is, it's not truly existent from the middle way consequence point of view. So we always end up with, we come back to our language.
Mm.
And this is why in the middle way consequence school, that's what they come down to. They say existing in mere name. There is something that's being named, of course. But what that is, you try and find it through analysis, you won't find it. And that's why it's called mere name. Things exist in mere name.
They can't exist without the name.
Without that name, they don't exist without that name as that thing.
I like Lama Yeshe. He just always goes back to energy. Everything is kind of energy fields, and which fits in quite well with quantum physics. So it sort of
describes. Again, you've got to go to quantum. This is a conventionality. It's an agreement.
And it's a name.
So we come back to it. It's like us always wanting to find something like beneath it and go, well, that's it. But like, you know, so you've got to present things in a way that is suitable for the reader or the listener. So Lama Yeshe presents as energy. You go, yeah, lots of people get energy.
And actually with the quantum thing, which is what I love, is that it's even more subtle than energy. It's possible energy. So it's or probable energy. We haven't even, you know, it's not even about is there energy there or not. It's just like what's the probability of it. So that's kind of like almost over from the physical to to the ultimate truth. It's like the right delineation right there. There's the line.
So you can see that, you know, our discussion is really about analysis and wisdom. Like, because once you start like going into things like this, this is what we sort of mean by wisdom. So let's now have a look at this next that I've put up. And it's interesting, isn't it? How wise we can become, but fail to apply it. So what do you think? What might some of the problems be when we fail to apply the wisdom that we understand that have arisen through, like, analysis, for instance?
Now, Eddie, you have to direct traffic here and actually have a look at people and see if they're waving at you or if people...
Oh, I can't actually see that.
We've got quite a few people here. So there is a little icon under the where you can reactions, where you can actually raise your virtual hand, and Eddie will be able to see that.
Any virtual hands? How are you going with this, Angela? Your first time here, I think. Okay, so these are some of the things that can happen when we fail to apply wisdom. Yeah. The afflictions arise. In particular, arrogance, pride, and envy. So Kinsa Rinpoche said, we need to recollect the good qualities of wisdom, but we also need to be careful because there are certain faults that can come about with wisdom. That is when a person thinks that knowledge is most important but fails to apply that to their minds. So then this arrogance, pride, and so forth arise, right? So we need to be careful not to do that. At the same time, we need to recollect and try to cultivate the good qualities of wisdom. So actually, some of the other traditions, really put, the Nyingma in particular, put quite an emphasis on the compassion that arises through wisdom. The compassion is a natural expression of the wisdom realizing emptiness. And if you think about this, you'll draw the same conclusion.
Eddie, I can see how compassion's a natural result of understanding dependent arising, but how come a step further, emptiness?
Okay. So because people who don't realise emptiness grasp at phenomena to inherently exist when they don't and cause themselves all the suffering. This is a natural outcome of grasping. So from that, you can see, wow, if you get some insight into this and see this, you know, the vast field of all sentient beings who lack inherent existence but are grasping at it all the time and in response to that, creating all the suffering for themselves. The natural compassion for those beings will arise. As you point out before, the flip, and the what do you call it? The
Flip side.
Joining understanding of empty is dependent arising, isn't it? So all the sentient beings dependently exist, yet at the same time they dependently exist, they're empty, and yet they grasp at the opposite way of the actual existence.
So in my mind, I'm thinking of dependent arising is like applied emptiness. You know, it's emptiness in action, in a way.
Yeah, and the most skillful way you can apply it is by looking at beings as if they were illusions, existing like an illusion, existing like an apparition, existing like echoes. But then that stops you grasping at it. And this is what they say, isn't it? It says, once you've realized persons are empty of inherent existence through your meditations, even a correct conceptual understanding of that, but that should have some impact on you. And then saying, wow, we're actually going against everything that we actually are. So, of course, it's a crazy world we're living in because we're sort of crazy. And yet it doesn't have to be that way. And one of the ways we can stop it, for ourselves at least, is to engage in the world as if the world were like a dream or an illusion. Not because it stops you clinging, it stops you grasping. You still have to act in it. It's not like you don't act. You do. Anyway, these teachings of wisdom, for instance, but also compassion, or the method side, are contained within what they call realization and scripture. And so they were asking, what are the two types of teachings? And please explain each of them briefly. So the first, of course, is the three scriptural collections. When you ask them, like, what do you mean? You know, what are these actual three? Then it sort of jumps out to what they call the nine. And there's all different, say, what have sutras, birth stories, a whole lot of different stuff that's contained in like a library of books. You know, like for us, one of those books would be the Lam Rim Chinmo. So we're trying to read that, study it, talk about it, reflect upon it and so forth, but we're trying to actually realize what's in those books. And so there we have the three higher trainings. And these are, of course, ethics, concentration, and wisdom itself. So the three higher trainings we're engaging in them because they actually bring about liberation. And all this other stuff in the scriptural collections is saying, look, this is what samsara is like. You need somebody to help you, like a teacher. These are the teachings on karma. This is how karma works. All that sort of thing. And then, you got to come to this conclusion where you're like, well, I want to put an end. Can an end be put to it? Can it be stopped in any way? And then they go, yes. You'll need to put into practice what you've read and studied.
So, Eddie, is this why the three higher trainings go together, why it's not just wisdom, but why we've got, ethics in there too, so that we don't fall into that trap of just getting intellectual? Well, and then those afflictions and the pride and all that arising.
The wisdom has to be supported by the concentration, otherwise it's unstable. And the concentration is held by a sense of ethics. So they support one another, but the baseline is an ethical way of being in life, because that means your mind can calm down. With the mind calm, then you can build on it and develop concentrated states. Then with these concentrated states, you can take the wisdom and analyze oneself and the other phenomena. And so the wisdom's the concentration sort of holds it, it's stable. Without it, it can't be done. Like for us, right? So we have all of these. We have some degree of ethical behavior, concentration, and wisdom. But then if we try to meditate on emptiness and the reasons, I don't know how long we'd be able to do it, but it probably wouldn't be for very long. So these two go together. And of course we need to use these two together. So we are doing our best to be ethical people right now. You know, we're not killing human beings, we're not taking what's not given to us, not stealing, we're not engaged in sexual misconduct. We're doing our best not to use harsh speech, idle speech, and so forth. And we're doing our best to have as little malice as possible, to not be envious, and to try and develop correct views rather than wrong views. So we're engaged in that now, and that's all coming about through our reading and our study. So we're trying to develop some sort of stability to gain greater certainty. And the greater certainty is coming in depends upon the study of the scriptures, but the engagement with the practice of the higher trainings. Now, if we weren't interested in liberating ourselves from cyclic existence or becoming a Buddha, you just put the higher trainings aside. But we wouldn't be engaged in that. You would be engaged, though, in like dropping the 10 non-virtuous behaviours, because that has an impact on you in life, in ordinary life. So you'd be just working within that paradigm. So Lama Tsongkhapa gave some terrific advice. Sorry. The manifestation of wisdom, Manjushri, gave Lama Tsongkhapa some terrific advice on how to become profoundly certain about what he'd studied in scripture and his using the foundation of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And so he said, if you wish to become profoundly certain about what you're studying, do this. See your teacher and the deity as being indivisible, one and the same. Then make requests to them. Confess all your negativities and accumulate merit of every type. And this is the best way to generate realizations of anything. And of course, on the way to realizations, you say like every good quality in your mind will develop by doing this. Fran, yep, you've got something to say? Yep. You've got your little thing. There you go.
My mouth consciousness isn't working either. I didn't actually hear what the three scriptural collections were.
Well, so I was going to say, Fran, so look, the three can come back into the nine, but one is like just the sutras themselves. Then you've got all the texts that have to do about behavior, ethics. And then the texts that have to do with wisdom. So in terms of in the Pali tradition, they call them the three baskets. The baskets of the Vinaya, or another, the behavior for the ordained. The teachings themselves called sutras. And then the Abhidharma texts, which categorize all phenomena. Within the Mahayana, they actually take those three and put them into nine and then bring them back down again. Now, so here we're trying to become profoundly certain, in other words, develop a certain and sharp type of wisdom. The wisdom itself, as we know, can be divided up into different ways. So when we talk about the dividing wisdom up within the perfections, you can talk about wisdom, ultimate wisdom, meaning emptiness from the middle way consequence point of view. It's always emptiness, wisdom realizing emptiness itself. The conventional wisdom, the dependent arising, cause and effect, karma. and in the wisdom that knows how to look after living beings. Now, another way of talking about the wisdom of the conventional is the wisdom that's proficient or knowledgeable about the five topics of knowledge.
So, Eddie, this divisions of wisdom is very interesting, because I'm thinking, I've only ever kind of thought in my mind, oh, the ultimate and conventional, but
yeah.
In this time of COVID, the wisdom of the welfare of living beings, looking after living beings, like that's become the thing that's the most challenging, because you can understand about the, you know, the rules of the masks and the this's and the that's, you can do all of your research, but actually then communicating with living beings in an efficient manner, it's got nothing to do with logic. In fact, the only way to do it is to be completely emotive and work on a totally different level and not even talk about COVID. So there is a real wisdom that's needed in there of like actually relating to others that can on the surface look quite contradictory to a conventional wisdom understanding cause and effect, for instance. You know, because how you have to communicate with others is quite different. You can't, especially when with COVID, you can't use reasoning, because that just backs people more into a corner with their preconceptions. Emotionally, they get backed in. They can't hear any logic or reasoning.
I don't know if you're speaking to them, no, but if you drew out their logic or reasoning, then it might be quite different.
If they're feeling emotionally safe, but if they're not feeling emotionally safe, they'll just say, well, I don't believe that.
I say, well, that's okay. You can't come in. That's all right.
So can you tell us more about this wisdom of the welfare of living beings?
Well, beings are suffering. So to help them, we need both the wisdom realizing emptiness, meaning everything dependently arising, coming back into the conventional of these five forms of five topics of knowledge. So let's move to those and we'll see how these can help beings who are disagreeable.
The lovely disagreeable beings, yeah. The dear disagreeable beings.
So, the question is, in reference to a wisdom that knows the conventional, what knowledge must the bodhisattva pursue? The knowledge the bodhisattva has to pursue are these five topics of knowledge. So here we've got some clues here. So first of all, you say, look, even a supreme noble being does not reach the state of Buddhahood without understanding and making effort at the five topics of knowledge. So here's what so they must strive for these to refute others. So when the person comes and says, I don't believe in that, you've got to have some knowledge to refute their disbelief. Yeah. To care for others, yet you've still got to be doing it out of a sense of caring for them and to know everything. So there you go. Know everything, you'll be right. So let's have a look at and see what these five topics of knowledge are. All right, so the first two are language and logic. So as you know, so when people come in with a COVID thing, you have to know like how to use the language, how to speak. And many different forms of logic. So it might be like consequential logic. It's like hearing their point of view, taking it, and turning it around so they see the foolishness of it, which is a consequence way of doing things. It's just like you say, if you come at them just with the logic, they're not interested. They can't even hear it. So as I say, that type of doesn't work. You don't come at them with your logic. What's your logic? How have you come to believe what you do? So these two here, the first two here, this is what you need to do so to be able to refute the other. So the other brings in their beliefs, but through language and logic, you can refute their beliefs, especially with wrong belief. To care for others, you're introducing the arts and the medicine. So it's like they're already on side. Well, they're not back here in the first section, they're in the second section. They're on side.
Or actually, Eddie, if you cared for someone, say with medicine, then they're much more likely to listen and you were able to actually help them. They're much more likely to have their loyalty, their openness towards you, to listen to the language and logic.
Yeah, well, they've already sort of got through already with their own, through the language and logic, right? They're already on side. And lastly, oneself, you have to know the inner sciences. So, of course, this is really talking about Buddhist psychology. You've got to be proficient yourself. You've got to have realization. The Geshe Sopra says, the purpose of studying these five sciences is to benefit other sentient beings. The reason that these five types of knowledge are mentioned is because they assist bodhisattvas achieve their aim to help other sentient beings by leading them to either emancipation or complete enlightenment. Each of the five sciences has its own purpose, but the common function of them all is to attain Buddhahood. So there's another question asked which has to do with these five, which basically we've already answered, is why is it necessary for a bodhisattva to know them all? And then why must we know them too? So we might not be bodhisattvas yet, but we say we have to learn them. We have to get to know them. Well, like I said, the first two you have to go with for those who don't believe. People say, I don't believe that. So we have to deal with them. We try to have to help them. So for those who don't believe, we've got to find logical ways of working with the logic and ways of working with language. But for those who do believe, we've introduced them to the arts and the medicines. But again, for oneself, we have to have the inner sciences, and the only way to become an inner scientist is through learning through scripture and then realizing it. So again, from Geshe Sopra, he says, in order to free other beings from suffering, a bodhisattva must be able to help them to eliminate the wrong views that cause them to act badly. The first two sciences, language and logic, are the means to defeat sentient beings' internal negative obstacles. Bodhisattvas also offer help to those who do not hold wrong views. So some sentient beings have more affinity for the correct view, and we can introduce them to the path to freedom. To that end, we offer them ordinary, temporary benefits. We help them with the third science, making things such as art or buildings, and the fourth science, medicine. People respond positively when we help them in these temporal ways. They will like us and become willing to follow us. So you'll see how this is developed later on when you come to the four ways of gathering disciples. It's after developing that type of relationship, we can move on to our main objective, showing them the spiritual path. This is the fifth science, the inner science, knowledge of the spiritual practices, their objectives, their obstacles, and the methods and techniques of meditation on all levels of the path. This also includes knowing karma and its results and the Four Noble Truths. From conceptually understanding and then practicing, we attain various experiential realizations. And gradually, as our wisdom grows, our ignorance is cleared away until we attain omniscience. And then we have the real wisdom. But on the way, we're developing. And of course, we're not enlightened, so we can only help for those who don't believe. We can just do the best we can. And we can work out what doesn't work and don't do that. The first one is restrain yourself from knowing what doesn't work. You know, so one is just don't throw a tantrum, for instance. You know, and then throw out a threat. Yes, you know, because we know people, we don't like being threatened. Well, guess what? Neither does someone else. Is it comfortable standing in front of people while they throw tantrums?
Or also, Eddie, don't just tell someone that's not logical.
Yeah, that's right.
They may not give a damn about that either.
That's right. Yes, oftentimes what you're trying to do is to look beneath their language to see what's the feeling going on here. What's the emotive factor that they're coming from? And address that issue.
Which is really where's the suffering? So address the immediate suffering, and then you can start addressing what's deeper.
Yeah, it was like I said, you know, like I said before, like the language just gets laid on top. You know, it's like the language I said before, they're just symbols pointing to something else. So one of the things that they say, like, I don't believe in that. So, you know, okay, so they're coming from a place of distress already. Did they want to be here? They've come here for, you know, for sustenance of some sort. So knowing all these five topics helps us develop the conventional wisdom so that we're able to actually be of benefit to sentient beings. So what makes wisdom a bodhisattva deed? Anybody like to have a guess? I'm sure somebody knows. Linda, what do you think?
I'm trying to find my unmute button. It was hidden down underneath. you have to have a motivation of mind of enlightenment or bodhicitta.
That's right. That's right. That's what makes any of these factors the deeds of a bodhisattva. So it's the mind of enlightenment. That's the bottom line. That's the foundation of it all. Then we have the wisdom, then it becomes a bodhisattva deed. So you could put generosity there. You could put ethics there. It don't matter. But if it's driven by the mind of enlightenment, a wish to become enlightened for their benefit, to make them enlightened, it's a bodhisattva deed. So you'll see this. In fact, all the perfections are like this. It's what drives them. It's the intention behind it. As Geshe has been saying in the chapter we're studying, you know, which will come up again in the Easter break, you'll see that all the perfections are basically driven by the mind of enlightenment. They're all consciousnesses. Now, we need wisdom. And if we don't have it, there's problems. And if we do have it, there's a lot of advantages to it. So let's have a look at some of the problems and the faults that come about if we don't try to fill the need for wisdom, if we don't try to become wiser persons. First of all, we're going to contradict the principal precept, which is we are engaged in the study of the Buddha Dhamma to become fully awakened beings. But now, to become a fully awakened being, we need the wisdom realizing emptiness. So if we're not going to study the wisdom realizing emptiness, we're contradicting our actual aspirations. Of course, all sorts of faults will arise. Well, anyone knows that is not wise. So most of us, when we're younger, we're not very wise, so we get ourselves into lots of problems. So as we've grown older, we'd hope to be sort of getting a bit wiser. So that means studying the wisdom, realizing emptiness, but and then the other side is dependent arising. That dependent arising includes karma, ethics, everything. Everything, if it exists, it does so dependently. As a dependent arising, it's empty of intrinsic existence. So we've got the natural faults, and then we've got all the different infractions. So as you know, if you've taken the vow of the engaging in the bodhisattva conduct, there are a lot of promises you've made. So these will all be broken. Infractions will occur. Not only that, there's no real pleasure in this broad learning. Finally, of course, you're unable to learn the bodhisattva trainings. So if we have this wish to become fully awakened, we need wisdom. But if we're not interested in developing it, these are just a few of the problems that will arise. Of course, there are many, many more. You'll see in the text. I just stuck up a few that I could.
So, Eddie, just before you go on, so this one, say, no pleasure in broad learning. Can we, like, reverse engineer that and go, if we're beginning to feel really mentally tired or we're not totally excited about Dharma study, it means that we haven't developed enough wisdom or we've lost an element of wisdom?
Yes, you know, so one of the things that has stuck with me was the advice that His Holiness gave for those who, before committing themselves to becoming a Buddhist. Right? So he said, study broadly. But now there are some teachers who say, no, don't do that. And that might be good advice for a particular type of student. But for me, all I've got is just more and more admiration for the Buddha Dharma by reading as widely as I can. And I get a lot of pleasure out of that sort of reading. I like to see how different teachers will say dissimilar things about the same subject. Yeah. I like it when... for instance, reading that book, Letter to Dharma Zopa, when people would come with the same problem and he'd give them different advice.
Dear Lama Zopa.
Yeah, so it's like that if you have broad learning, you can go, it's acceptable to you because it's dependent arising. So a lot of things become very sort of easier. And you understand there are many, many different types of antidotes to the different problems we face.
Actually, that's really a good point, Eddie, because I remember, in my 20s, I did heaps of reading of Western philosophy, which I was very, very excited about, Nietzsche and all of these, postmodernists and things. But I would always come back to the Buddhist teachings because even though they weren't necessarily written in such an exciting manner, the wisdom in there was like just the go-to thing. It just became clearer and clearer that this was the one that actually made the most sense, even though it wasn't necessarily the most entertaining or written in the most, wild and wonderful way.
So the other thing is, the benefits, of course, are to learn the bodhisattva training. So one of the greatest things I found with the bodhisattva trainings is thought transformation. Because things are empty and dependent, thought transformation, what you can do with that, turning terrible sufferings into actual advantages for yourself. That's tremendous. And then, so we need to complete the collections of sublime wisdom. That brings about what we call the omniscience of a Buddha. So we actually know what others need specifically and help them. Now I've come up to this new topic, so this is only introduced to today. It's the last couple of slides, and it's really covered in next week. a new section called The Four Ways of Gathering Disciples. We look at this. What the four ways are, the reason they're stipulated as four, their functions, the need for those who gather a following to rely on them, and a somewhat elaborate explanation. So next week we go into depth on like all of these. Today is just sort of introducing to them. So what are these four ways of gathering disciples? So the first way of gathering a disciple is through the practice of generosity. The point of being generous is to start up a relationship and then make the relationship close and kind. Fran, yep.
Why are we wanting to gather disciples? And is the disciples for a word for something else? Is this just sort of to get people to agree with us and follow our way of thinking? Or are we wanting to become great teachers and do everything?
Both, friend. So we need to get people to follow our way of behavior and thinking because we're leading them to Buddhahood. And that's what we're to do.
I was just looking at it from a very mundane point of view, and I didn't.
No, not from mundane.
No
mundanity here.
But on a really basic level, Fran, it's like, you know, in our own family and our own friendship circle, and maybe our neighbours and our community, we're the ones that have to be able to help them. We're the ones to help them when there's an emergency, or when someone's dying, or when they lose their pet, or have a marriage breakup. So this thing of gathering disciples, this is so we have a good relationship, so we can step in with some Dharma wisdom, because otherwise they have nothing. Most people are completely bereft of any kind of advice.
I think it was just my way of looking at the word disciples, you know, and maybe I was looking at it from the biblical sense as well, and not, I was just sort of wondering, what the disciple actually was. Yeah. Thanks, so, Eddie and Missy. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, in the beginning, the first disciples we've got, if you're a family person, will be your kids. They're your original disciples. Then we're going to sort of take that same way of having a good relationship with our children, a close relationship with them, and expand it. So we begin with generosity. That's one of the ways of gathering the disciples. Why do we are generous? To develop a relationship that's close and warm. Secondly, we're going to deal with them with using pleasant speech. It says, you know, to use pleasing words. So to give good advice in a nice way, a way that's suitable for the disciple. Following on from that, now we give them instruction. So the instruction here, of course, is in the perfections, because we're trying to lead them into Buddhahood itself. But remember here, from us, we're coming at it with the mind of enlightenment. It doesn't mean the student is yet. And then we ourselves have to act consistently. We cannot tell people what to do if we're not doing it. Because if we do, it doesn't imbue the disciple with confidence. It's that sort of thing, you know. We say, yeah, I know you're telling me to do that, but you're not doing it. Why should I do it?
It's like the politicians not wearing a mask.
No, that's right. So we've lost faith in them. So here we have these four ways, and they're going to explain in the last chapter. So one of the things that they say there later on is that the Bodhisattva practices two things, the six perfections and the four ways of gathering disciples. The perfections are for their own development. These are for the development and help of others. So next, last question is, why are these four, why are they these four, and why are they in this order? So a quote from the Lamrim, it says, this is the method to benefit others. They are in this order to cause understanding. First of all, you know, it benefits others when you are generous. To cause understanding through pleasant speech. To cause involvement with the instructions. And acting in accordance with oneself. These should be understood as the four ways to gather disciples. So again, from Geshe Sopa, he says, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas help sentient beings in countless ways, but all the methods can be subsumed into these four practices. The primary way to achieve happiness is to engage in a spiritual practice that clears away ignorance, wrong views, doubts, and so forth. In order to engage in practice, we need to know how to do it. So we have to find a teacher who is likable, and his or her advice is worth following. If we're not happy to be around someone, then we go away and that person has no way to help us. Thus, to help others attain true and long-lasting happiness, we first of all give them some material things to please them. So you'll see this often, like guests are sitting at the airport with a bag of lollies. He's offering lollies out to everyone. And everyone's got this big smile on their face. And they're just lollies. But we like it, don't we? We feel warm. We feel close to them.
And Eddie also, Geshe-la said, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche has also said that these four means of gathering disciples is like every person who volunteers in a Dharma center, this is the main practice.
Okay. So he says, look, even Christian missionaries engage in this way. They give food, medical care, and other forms of charity as a basis for offering spiritual help. In fact, these four methods to help others spiritually mature are sometimes translated as the four conversions. He says, now I know you're not going to like that, but that's the term they use. So, is it offering first of all? Then there's encouragement to learn. We give them instructions. However, they're never going to listen to us if we're not doing it. So, we have to embody what we're talking about. This is fourth one, they're acting in accordance with yourself. Anyway, these are the four ways of gathering disciples, and the next week is like all about it, and then that finishes off this whole section. So we looked at sort of 20 questions here. This is what's coming up. So you might like to take a note of these things, because this is where the next teachings are. So only another 10 pages on volume 3, and volume 3 is finished, the Geshe Sopa's volume. Only 5 pages in volume 2 of the Lamrim Chenmo, and that's finished too. And you can see down here, next teaching is teaching 15, pages 25 to 38. So like I said, next week we finish off the four ways of gathering disciples. And then we'll be into the perfection of concentration. So that probably take us to the end of the year. I wouldn't be surprised. And then we'll be on the wisdom. Do you guys have anything you'd like to say or ask or? So it was a little bit easier than the tenets section, wasn't it?
I just had a thought where you sort of say, you know, don't ever eat anywhere if the cook won't eat their own food.
Yeah,
you know,
there you go. That's a good one, friends. Just like that.
You know, so it's the same as I would find it very, very hard to establish any connection with somebody who's expounding the things of compassion and then they're just being mean-spirited and kicking dogs and aren't kind to children. You know, you have to the talk or whatever,
Yeah, you might even think there's something wrong with the teaching itself. Hey, if this person's not doing it, he's telling me to do it, but he doesn't do it himself. Well, I don't have much confidence in a teaching that's like that.
It's just really astute psychology, just the order of it, the main things, you know, especially how the generosity comes before an explanation. So people need their immediate needs met before they can hear anything else. And also people just become really open. So, you know, when new people come to Langri Tama Centre and we offer a free book, you know, that's one of our things that we're trying to do to create this relationship of generosity with others that doesn't matter whether they ever come back again. Here's something, an auspicious gift to give you to have it turn out well.
So let's dedicate the energy that I've put forward into studying, folks. So I think that due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. I acknowledge that enlightened state, all living beings, the goal of Buddhahood itself, we who are engaging in actions, lack inherent existence and do exist conventionally, independence upon name, basis of designation, cause and conditions and parts. May the supreme dual body chitta not get born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. So while space endures and while beings can be found within space, may we too remain to drive away the sorrows of their world. Okay, whoa, another one done.